Good evening and welcome to the Asian American Asian Research Institute's lecture series. Good Friday to all of you coming out on this gorgeous Friday evening to join us for an interesting book talk tonight. I'm Anthony Wong, Program Coordinator at the Institute. Thank you for joining us for our book talk with Professor Zai Liang on his recent publication, From Chinatown to Every Town, How Chinese Immigrants Have Expanded the Restaurant Business in the United States. Thank you to the CUNY Graduate Center's Immigration Seminar Series for co-sponsoring tonight's talk. Professor Liang has actually previously participated in a 2014 panel discussion we had at the Institute, which we co-sponsored with Hunter College, organized by our late friend Peter Kwong, on research methods and approaches in the community. And that video is actually available on our website to view, as well as in print in our journal, CUNY Forum Volume 5. Zai Liang is Distinguished Professor and Chair of Sociology at SUNY State University of New York at Albany, SUNY Albany. He currently serves as Chair-Elect of the International Migration Section of the American Sociological Association and was visiting scholar at the Russell Sage Foundation in New York City. He is the recipient of the 2018 SUNY Chancellor's Award for Research and Creative Activities and the 2020 Lewis Worth Best Paper Award from the American Psychological Association. Professor Liang's research has been supported by many foundations, including National Science Foundation, National Institutes of Health, the Ford Foundation, Spencer Foundation, among others. From 2004 to 2022, he served as the director and co-director of the Urban China Research Network based in Albany. His main research interests are migration and immigration, urbanization, urban sociology, and China studies. Books are available for sale after the talk at $35 each, cash and card accepted. For those of you online, I dropped the link into the chat. You can purchase the books online and use the code SAVE30 to save 30%. And please welcome Professor Liang.
Thank you very much, Anthony, for the generous introduction. And I thank my colleagues at the Asian Research Institute, and also colleagues at the CUNY Graduate Center, the International Migration Program. And thank you, everybody, for coming in person, also in Zoom. I know it's a Friday evening, and you have all other options. Actually, there are two reasons that I think I'm particularly eager to be here this evening. I think one is that I was a faculty at CUNY many years ago. I was here for 10 years before moving to Upper State. So for me, I think this is like a homecoming. So it's a great feeling to be home. The second thing I think is to coming to CUNY to talk about my research, and I feel that I can't imagine any better place than here to talk about, because this is a story about New York City, Chinatown, and many of you in the audience I think are familiar with, been there. Some of the places that I show you will look familiar to you. So tonight the presentation is about Chinatown. Again, it should not be a very strange topic, should be familiar. I try to make some new points here, and hopefully that, and because it's Friday evening, I think my presentation I'm hoping to be a little bit more entertaining than, the regular presentation that I do in other contexts. So hopefully you appreciate that. So this is the book that I think Anthony also mentioned that a little bit. So it's about Chinatown, but also it's about how immigrants, they're moving away from Chinatown. This is a Chinatown in Manhattan, right? I'm going to begin with a picture, and this is the picture some of you may actually be familiar with. So in my teaching, I kind of use this picture because it shows how an iconic artist by the name of Andy Warhol, right? And the picture was taken in 1965, many years ago, and I think the first thing is that I want to show people is the impact of Chinatown and the Chinese restaurant on the local people, even the artists, very, very famous artists. And what is also interesting to see is that the time the picture was taken, actually, not only in 1965, but also in the very early morning, about 1:30, right? And, I've been to Chinatown many, many times, but I've never been to Chinatown at about 1:30 in the morning. But also, this is a gentleman who wears sunglasses, in the morning. So that's kind of an interesting thing that I want to show people. The second artist I'm going to show you today is Louis Armstrong. Many of you like his music. And in fact, his music not only influential in the U.S., but also important in China, because he sends down the students to play in the nightclub in Shanghai many years ago. And so he likes Chinese food, right? And in fact, if you Google this trumpet piece, has a Chinese dish in the title, right? Yeah, it's still clear if you Google and listen to that music on that. I think Chinese food is not foreign. In fact, it's quite popular. If you look at the Google search, this is based on the consumer's search, Friday evening, perhaps on the weekend, deciding where to go, right? And then the Google will identify what are the things actually customers are looking at, right? So basically, to look at the most popular searches ranked by the Chinese, Mexican, and Italian, and so forth. So clearly, this actually cut across many regional ethnic boundaries. And here in New York, I actually right now I'm in the middle of a new project looking at the Chinatown during the COVID. And one of the things we noticed is that if you look at Chinatown, this is Manhattan again, right? And our data suggests that the Manhattan Chinatown, right, during March to June 2019, this is like a 1 year before the lockdown in New York City, right? Yeah, so it's kind of a normal time before COVID. And the Chinatown visited by people from 83 countries, right? And I'm thinking, well, the neighborhood that I live in, Albany, I don't imagine, visited by 83 countries, right? And people from 83 countries. And people in this room may live in a neighborhood visited by more people. But to be visited by, 83 countries in about 3 months, that's quite global, right? Yeah. So I want to give you an image. So this is not a very isolated community, right, that you might imagine many, many years ago. Now, speaking about isolated communities, let's go back to over 100 years ago. So this is a picture that I took from the New York Public Library in 1899. So the Chinatown you see here, clearly, pretty much 100%, Chinese. And also pretty much 100% men. This is kind of a bachelor society that many of my Chinese American colleagues identified, right? Fast forward 125 years later. So if you, like me, took a picture, this is, the one that you saw earlier is the Pell Street, right? This is the traditional center of Chinatown. And this is, I think many of you are familiar with this, it's like a, Nanhua tea parlor. And you have to read, if you read the Chinese, you're going to read from this side, right? Nanhua Cha Shi, right? Yeah, not from left to right, but from right to left, sort of the traditional way you read Chinese. And if you compare two pictures, this is in Doyle Street. That's very, very close to Pell Street, right? And if you compare these two pictures, I think one thing striking is that here we see a lot more non-Chinese, right, than the first picture 125 years ago. So today, Chinatown has changed dramatically, right? This is just recent. Now, when you write a book, you're always thinking about, am I the first person who write about this topic, right? In fact, the answer is I'm not the first person who wrote a book about Chinatown. In fact, in my library at home, I have more than 20 books about Chinatown, including some of the books by the late colleague Peter Kwong and others. But they're considered to be a little bit more recent, you know, last, you know, two or three decades. And then preparing for talk, I was just thinking, you know, maybe I can look at the book maybe a little bit older. So it turns out that I was able to find a book by Louis Beck, B-E-C-K. So it turns out he wrote a book in 1898, right? Long before I started work on my project, right? And then he has, this is the Chinatown Hall, right? He identified, he has a picture showing there. It's maybe about 300 or 400 pages. It's quite a big book. And then Miss Beck, he also has a map. So I'm going to show my map as well. But, you know, in 1898, Mr. Beck showed this map of Chinatown. I just mentioned about Pearl Street, Doral Street right there, right? And for people who study Chinatown know this is what we typically consider the triangle place, right? Typically the major battle or fought among the gang members. But today it's very, very lively. But it's very clear, you know, 100 years ago, Chinatown was much, much smaller, right? This is just a small piece of Chinatown if you think about comparing to what we saw Chinatown today, right?
Yeah.
So, now again, back in, you know, fast forward to 2024, and this is February 25th, in the middle of celebration of the Lunar New Year, and we're happy to see that the governor of New York State, Kathy Hochul, is in. You know, she was in the attendance. This is the Consul General of the China, and then just 2 years. I think the mayor of New York City, Eric Adams, was there, but some reason that he didn't have time to participate in the parade. But if you look at 2 years ago, 2022. I think all the major figures of New York State powerful leaders, we have Kathy Hochul right there, and then the senator from New York, senior senator Charles Schumer, and then this is the mayor, and this is the president of the Chinese Immigrant Association, Mr. Zheng. So this is kind of the combination of leaders in the state of New York and in the city of New York, and also Immigrant Association on that beautiful day. But make no mistake, so this talk is not about a travel guide to Chinatown, you know, having a meal here, but I do have some serious messages to deliver. So my message is more about the spatial diffusion of the Chinese immigrant from Chinatown to other places. And I'm going to show you some pictures that we did in the process of doing this fieldwork. And one thing is that all these locations are not in New York City, right? Yeah, not in Chinatown. So one is called the Dragon Lee. And this is actually closer to where I live today. So it's close on the way to the Girl Mountain, the ski resort, right? Yeah, and in the middle of nowhere, and you also then, you, on the way to ski, you saw this place. And then the Shuangli Palace, and that's in North Carolina. And North Carolina happened to be one of the places we did our fieldwork. We talked to the immigrant entrepreneurs who opened business in that location. Now, this Fortune Cookie place on the lower left-hand side is the place in Texas, and also a place that we did our field work as well. So these are just a sample of the locations that we carry out the research. And so, but our research much broader, spatially much dispersed than what you just saw, the three locations. So the question, the simple question is, you know, how did this happen, right? This spatial diffusion from traditional you know, Chinatown in New York City to other locations. And so as a typical way that, you know, if you do research, you always talk about why I wanted to do this, right? So clearly, as a scholars, we care about inequality and social policy, and particularly involve low-skilled immigrant workers, In addition, I think in the context of New York City, maybe in the context of the U.S. as well, a pretty substantial portion of the immigrants actually are low-skilled, right? I think in the context in New York City for Chinese immigrants, we're talking about over 50% being classified by the New York City Planning Department as low-skilled workers. And then you can talk about this is a labor market for immigrant entrepreneurs. It's something all these scholars of Asian Americans care a lot, right? So that's. But I think I want to emphasize number three here in red, that to emphasize the contributions made by the low-skilled entrepreneurs, but also workers, right? Their contribution not only in terms of the providing the service that most the Americans enjoy, but also the contribution they are serving as a bridge that between the people and then cultures, right? Yeah, because when you're doing service work, you're interacting directly with consumers, right? Yeah, and that's very, very important. And I'm going to elaborate that in later part. So the other thing that I want to say a little bit about why, we kind of care about this spatial diffusion of immigrants from traditional destinations such as New York City, such as, Chicago, Boston, Philadelphia, to other faraway and sometimes, rural places, right? Yeah. And the spatial location is always being a center of, sociological research. So I think one question will be, I'm going to just concentrate on the second. When the immigrant move away from traditional destinations such as New York City to other places, there could be potential trouble for race and ethnic relations, right? And places they're not used to the arrival of new immigrants, right? So how do they get along? And the other thing is the potential separation of immigrants from their families, right? Sometimes they move along to work in a restaurant, and then their family members, their friend networks still based in New York City. I kind of emphasize another dimension that is, traditional immigrant destination like New York City. So we have very strong immigrant organizations, right? They can provide a lot of service. And New York City also, as we know, provide bilingual service. If you go to see a doctor, even drive a license test. And then immigrant-sponsored churches where you're going to pray in the language of your comfort, right? Yeah. And all these things will change the moment you move to a different, a new destination, what I call, right? So the project started actually around 2005, and so usually the intellectual production process takes a long time. And so this table that I show you, I kind of asked my student to work on this table because we were collecting data in Chinatown in 2005. So we were doing a survey of about 400 immigrants from China's Fujian province. And so in that process, we were working with the immigrant organizations. In that process, walking around Chinatown, I saw something kind of interesting, also different, and that is the large number of employment agencies that disperse in different parts of Chinatown, particularly not too far away from East Broadway. And I saw, well, this is something interesting we need to study. But, my project then wasn't to study employment agencies, but I do collect the data. So this is, we have maybe a few pages. So this one, I think in the English, it's called the Jackson Lee's Employment Agency. So Jackson Lee is an immigrant from Guangdong province. And so he has this office. And you can see that he lists all the telephone numbers, right, that posted in Jackson Lee's employment agency in 2005. And I got very fascinated by these numbers, right? Because when you look at these numbers, they're not simply numbers. They're actually indicating the location, right? The location of employment. And to me, that's very important, right?
Yeah.
And so my current project that's culminating in a book actually used information like this. So this is kind of the starting point. Now, the larger picture, if you look at the data from the U.S. Census, right? Yeah, so this is pretty well known. That is, if you ask immigrants, their current, the most recent immigrants, their destination state. And for example, if you compare that preference over times, for example, in 1990, right? And you will see that 35% of immigrants actually stay in the state of California. And look at that percentage drop to about 18.9% by 2010, right? In a matter of 20 years or so, right? You can see that this indicating that the spatial diffusion process took place during the 20 years from 1990 to 2010. And New York City is New York State. This is state. Yeah, this is similar, but not as dramatic as what we saw in California. And then one can also look at the story for different immigrant groups. For example, Mexicans. The Mexican story is very, very dramatic, right? You know, in 1990, 60% Mexicans settled in California, and then that turned. Dropped down to about 27% by, 2010, right? Yeah. And then the Asian immigrants have similar stories, so here as well, particularly California story, you can see there. So my point is that this is not a simple story just about Chinese immigrants, decide to move, from New York City to other places. This is a national trend that is not only for Chinese, but also for Latino immigrant. But clearly, if you look at the literature on this topic, in the mid-2000s, right? Yeah, and we see a lot of study on that. And typically, I didn't list a lot of details of the literature, but let me give you a quick summary. So basically, the literature on this topic of new immigrant destination tend to be going to the destinations. That is, if they find immigrant in somewhere, a small town in North Carolina, researcher will go there. They talk to the immigrant there, how things are going, and talk to the local people, right? How people, getting along with each other, right? So that's kind of a typical approach. Or if they find immigrant in the rural town in the state of Iowa, doing meat packing, business, and they'll go and talk to them. And to me, I think that's important. But it's not quite, to me, it's not quite satisfactory. I want to know more about the process. How did this whole thing, start in the first place, right? Who get the information sent to the immigrants? So they know that somehow there's a demand for meatpacking industry work, right? There's a demand for construction work. So I need to know the kind of a whole process. And so when I look at literature, my mind was thinking, wow, this actually connect to what I gathered in 2005, right? If you recall that particular one page, I saw that's a connection. I wanted to present the story about the Chinese immigrants. Now, the two unique things about Chinese immigrants in terms of spatial diffusion from traditional destination to new immigrant destination, one is the use of employment agency, as I documented a little bit earlier, right? And that's kind of interesting because if you study immigrant labor market, and the typical study will suggest your immigrants rely on a lot on the migration networks. So that means when they need to get a job, they ask for people who are from the same hometown, right? Or from the relatives. So it's a very strong network-based job search process, sort of the traditional way. And this employment agency, this does bring a market mechanism, right? So everybody can go to the agency and then look at the location of job, type of jobs, and then how much money is being paid. It's market-based, and that's quite different in terms of the labor market operation. So I think this is something that we got to, as researchers, we need to pay attention to that. The second story, I think, for the Chinese immigrant, spatial diffusion to the new destination, is the involvement of building a transportation infrastructure, right? And this is entirely, the Chinatown bus industry, entirely built by, ambitious immigrant entrepreneurs, right? You know, gather money together, and then start doing things. And this is actually a big deal, right? I mean, you can think about immigrant traditionally, start business, small business, corner store, laundromat, and so forth. But doing a bus company is entirely different operation. And I think to me that's really something we need to pay attention to. So this may be a little bit complicated, and the folks on the Zoom may not be able to see it very clearly. So let me just quickly mention what I'm trying to say here, right? So the story may be a little bit easier than may appears. When immigrants think about the going outside of New York City, and that based on their understanding of the local market in New York City, right? So I use term like market saturation. Think about the restaurant business, right? No matter how big the New York City market is, there's a certain point that market is going to be saturated, right? Yeah. So in the 1990s, I think we were at that particular point, right? So the market is saturation, right? And so therefore, you have some immigrants who arrived earlier, so they were able to accumulate capital, and then they're thinking, okay, where do I want to invest my money, right? And do I invest money in the, starting a business in New York City, or do I want to go to another place where the commercial rent may be more affordable, right? So that's kind of the calculation in the mind of many immigrant entrepreneurs. And the other side of the story is the rising immigration. So in the 1990s, this is a major increase of immigrants from China, particularly from China's Fujian province. You just cannot ignore. This is a very, very big volume, right? And so where do they get jobs, right? So New York City, even though it's very big, it cannot accommodate that large volume. So that's one thing happening, but also beyond the rising immigrant from Fujian province, we also see diversification immigrant from other provinces in China. So traditionally, we know that immigrants come from Taishan and other places in Guangdong, but also from Fujian. But starting 1990s, immigrants from China coming from all different provinces, right? So I have a map that can show you that. And that has been noted by writers, who are not Chinese, like some of the New Yorker writers. They noticed that. They published papers in New Yorker magazine. The National Public Radio noticed that as well. They noticed, for example, the immigrant from northern China instead of traditional southern. So that's also part of the story that contribute to the emergence of employment agencies. Because once you have the immigrant coming from such a diverse background, right, the importance of the network is being weakened, right? Yeah, because people from different province, they don't have the same dialect, right? Yeah. So therefore, the two major factors that I identify here, the transportation network, that's the Chinatown bus, and then the employment agency. So these are the two major organizations, so to speak, right? Yeah, that actually facilitate the spatial diffusion of immigrants from New York to other places. And that also become the national labor market. And this is another point that I made. So in the case of Chinese immigrants, it is not the labor market. It's not a regional market. This is a national labor market that I'm talking about. And This is, I'm going to mention that a little bit later. Now, let's back to Chinatown. So if you do a map of Chinatown, this is Manhattan, and then you see that roughly the lower part of Manhattan, very close to the water. And then here, I kind of copy a map from the BID, the Business Improvement District, the organization that they draw a nice map. I think it's kind of clear. And if you remember the map that I showed you earlier by Louis Beck, he was just talking about this is Pell Street, right? Yeah, so that Chinatown map is about here. So today, and the Chinatown map is multiple times larger. Now, the other story I want to show you, see, you can see that I actually do two circles, right? Yeah, some of you, when you go to Chinatown, maybe you go to the first circle, right? And the center today, perhaps around the Mott Street, M-O-T-T here, and then the major immigrant organization is in the Mott Street as well. And this is what I consider the old Chinatown, right? Yeah, so traditional, Taishan and Cantonese-speaking Chinatown, very, very vibrant today. But I want to emphasize that there's a second Chinatown. That is, this Chinatown along the East Broadway here, right? And this is where my research actually, spent a lot of time in this part of Chinatown, right? Not only on the East Broadway, but also the Allen Street, Eldridge Street, these places. So we walked on this street every store we kind of watch, and that's what I call the new Chinatown. Yeah. And meaning that there are a lot of new immigrants actually who start business there, and then they kind of live there at least before COVID. So the employment story I want to show a little bit. So this is the one on the left hand side. Is in English, it's called Tina Employment Agency. And amazingly, this agency actually, I took the picture maybe about 15 years ago, but today if you go to Doi Street, if you go to the, Huanan Tea Parlor, you see it's just right in the neighbor of the tea parlor. And what is interesting thing about this particular employment agency is that their customers actually, I would say, maybe about 90%, 100% Latino workers, right? And not Chinese workers. And so this getting to the point that I showed you at the beginning, I want to get a message out that is, Chinatown impact is so broad, right, in terms of affecting the artists, affecting, global, travelers, but also affecting other immigrants in the country, right? In this case, very large number of Latino workers there. And the other one actually is Fuzhou is the employment agency there. It's in the what I call the new Chinatown on the right-hand side in the map I just showed you, right? And if you go, just take one more step going inside, and typical story is something like this you'll see, right? So there's a small piece of paper, like a post-it, if you're a casual observer, you just look and then you leave. But I think this is for researcher. This is very valuable information, right? So therefore, my research team, when there, we gather all the information posted there because it had the spatial location, right? You can see here. I think maybe this one here, 312. This is the location of the telephone error code, right? And therefore, you know the location. This is 203, probably in Connecticut, right? Yeah, 312, I suspect maybe Maryland. And it shows you the salary the employer agreed to pay, right? This is very open, right? This is, upfront. This is how much you may be paid, right? And then, for a new immigrant who is not very familiar with the, geography of the U.S., when they see a telephone error code, there'll be lost first, right? And the thing is that in the employment agency, typically you're giving a map like this, right? So I got this for $1. And so this map was showing all the I think we have over 270-something telephone error code. And so the staff member in the agency will say, look, you know, you got a job in this location here, maybe in Albany, right? Maybe the place not too far from where I live. Maybe somewhere in the south, right? Maybe in Florida. And so the immigrant will have a rough idea where they're going, right? You know, on a map, and then through Chinatown bus. So this is what we did. We collect all the information here, like I said, and including the salary here, right? Yeah. So in the process, I want to make sure how much time that I have. I'm doing okay, right? Timing wise, right? Okay, thank you. So this is the kind of data we collected. So I mentioned about the survey of employment agencies. We actually did two, you know, one in 2010 and 2011. So it was a pretty simple survey, so to speak. You know, I had maybe two or three graduate students came with me on the Amtrak, so we stay in the a cheap hotel in Flushing, and then we just spend most of the time in Chinatown doing the work. And before doing the survey, I always talk to the staff member in there, you know, saying, you know, who I am, and I told them that, you know, tomorrow I'm going to come with my assistant, and I think most cases they're very supportive. But maybe one or two, they say, you know, we don't really want you to collect the data. So there were some rejections. But for the most part, I think they're pretty, and they do have a request. They say, you know, why don't you come actually after lunch, and where there be, you know, office is not too busy, you know, not a problem. So we'll just follow that. So beyond that survey of employment agencies, where we gather all the job information across the whole country, we also did a survey, in-depth interviews of these immigrant entrepreneurs who operate business in the state of Ohio, Pennsylvania, Virginia, North Carolina, Florida, and Texas. So my assistant will be sending. We've been going there, right? You know, in different time, normally about a week in each location, and we also interview the owners of employment agencies, and we talk to the Chinatown bus owners. I've been talking to them for a long time, even after I finished my book. So all these details are talked about in the book. And then there's also another player. So far, I haven't mentioned that. And these are the owners of business supply stores, right? And typically, if you go to Chinatown, you don't tend to go to these places, right? Because these are the places they provide service about printing restaurant menus, right? About restaurant supplies, surveillance cameras, right? You know, these are the things that you need to operate a restaurant business. And during COVID, actually, when I was revising the book, we also conducted additional interviews with workers to see how they were doing during COVID. The business owners to see how they were doing in the COVID as well. So we have additional things. So this a little bit technical. So I'm gonna just skip. So if you imagine in the book, there are actually two parts of the book. One is probably a little bit technical. That is, we do a lot of data manipulation, different, you know, statistical models, but they're in the appendix, right? So the editors at the publisher, they told me not to. Yeah, so that's, so the text will have an easier interpretation of the findings, but the more complex tables, I placed in appendix. So that's one part, a little bit quantitative, but then the other part, maybe about 50% will be pretty much based on the qualitative research, you know, where we, you know, analyze data from the interviews, the field work in different locations. I think these are very, very accessible to all readers. So I want to bring a little bit, you know, so far, you know, I was talking about, you know, what I did as a researcher along with my research team. But I want to give people an impression this is not my own observation, right? So many people have noticed this. So I'm going to start with the Wall Street Journal, right? And now look at this. This is the 2005. It's the front page of the Wall Street Journal, right? So how often our Chinese immigrant community stories will be covered by the front page of Wall Street Journal? In my 40 years in the U.S., this is the only time that I saw that. You know, I subscribed to the Wall Street Journal. And so that's an amazing story, right? It's a story about Chinatown bus, right? And right here in New York, not too far from, you know, the 43rd Street. And the idea is that they noticed that somehow the Greenhound bus has lost some customers, right? And they figure out, and that's because something they realize that immigrants somehow operate this kind of business, right? And Greenhound bus, as we know, has a capital value of $1 billion. It's a big operation, so it is a interesting story. Somehow, such a big company somehow lost a customer to the Chinese immigrant owned the business, right? So that became a national news. But of course, Andrew Newman, who wrote that article, he probably didn't quite understand what's the story behind it, right? Yeah. So my job is to provide a little bit of context why they lost, right? And there's actually more story to the bus later. And beyond the Wall Street Journal, we actually saw the politicians, right? In 2005, for example, former President Bill Clinton was in Chinatown, and this time he was trying to get some donation from the, to support Hillary Clinton's running for the Senate, senator from New York State. And then you have other media, the Economist and the New York Times, and they all notice the similar story that I was doing as a researcher, right? So you can see I was not alone. So that can make me happy that people are actually paying attention to this kind of issue. Now, I want to give you a little bit of story about Chinatown Bus. So this Chinatown Bus story began in 1997, right, by a person named Pei Lin Liang, and they happen to have the same last name with me, but I we're not related, right? So Mr. Liang, actually, he is an immigrant from Guangdong province, and so he was doing different kind of jobs in Brooklyn. And one time that he was told that there's kind of a demand for immigrant family to send their children to a college in Boston. So as we know, Boston has many, many universities, colleges, you know, Harvard, MIT, you know, Boston College, and Tufts University, and so forth. So he said, well, you know, I can start a service. So he did, and that was like a minimum, right? Maybe 12 passengers, and not like this. And so because he can see that he's Cantonese, and the way that you can see that this is Cantonese spelling of the Fenghua bus, right? But it turns out when he started, the demand actually getting bigger, right? So there's just so many more people wanted to, you know, go to Boston, you know, come back to New York. And then he said, I'm going to expand my business, right? The small bus become bigger bus, right? And so here this is, you know, he specialized New York to Boston all the way. But the story has not a very happy ending. You know, his business was very good, and his bus service touches so many people's heart. So many people use, you know, the college students, and even some of the New Yorker magazine writer and use his bus service. But somehow, as you probably read from the either the Chinese newspaper in New York or the national paper, that, you know, some of the China bus got in trouble because of the accident. So apparently, Mr. Liang's business in a similar. So the Department of Transportation decided to suspend his license. He said, you know, you're gonna work on the following the regulations. So he hired a lawyer and to go through the process. Eventually, he won the battle, but it took a long time, and he just exhausted. And eventually, he says, you know, I don't want to do this anymore. So this is not a, but many, so this name, Feng Hua Bus, many people know this name, right? And so beyond the Feng Hua, there are many, many bus companies in Chinatown, right? Yeah, so we did two things. We kind of walk on the foot and then look for this, office in Chinatown. And then we also look at their website. So this is, we did this in 2017 and 18. And today, some of the bus actually, no longer in operation after COVID. But at the height of the Chinatown bus operation, this is as many as I didn't count maybe 20 something bus companies, right? There's so many. In fact, one of the big companies you can see here, One Da Company, right? One Da Coach, and some of you know that One Da is a major, very very big company in China. The owner of One Da, he's a billionaire. I don't know whether he put money, but apparently, they use the name, so I suspect maybe there's a connection. So I talked to some of the companies, like the Eastern Bus, and then these two, three companies about their experience. One of the things about Eastern Bus Company is that this is the only bus company that I know of actually being operated by someone with an MBA degree. So this gentleman who operates bus has an MBA from the Sean Lewis. Right. Washington University in St. Louis. It's a good school. And others more or less self-taught, and they kind of pick up what they learn. And then I look at the operation number of destination cities, like the One Da Company here, right? Yeah. So they serve like 39 destinations in the U.S., and number of trips per day, and so forth. And so I asked one of my assistant to draw a map like this. You know, if you travel on an airplane, United, Delta, and you see on that magazine, they have a map showing, okay, with Delta, United will fly from here to, Amsterdam to Florence and any other place. So I said, well, why don't we draw a map like that and starting New York City and then see how many places the Chinatown bus will operate, right? And so one thing you see clear, and you can see on the East Coast, the thickness of the line indicating the number of bus companies that providing service. And clearly, the East Coast, there are a lot of competition. Yeah, on New York to Boston, there are a lot of competition, even among the Chinese-owned companies. And then from New York to Philadelphia, major competition. And in fact, and the folks who visited Chinatown some years ago, and you will see that one of the companies, not a Chinese operated company, but it's a mainstream bus company operated on Allen Street, and it's competing right there in Chinatown with the Chinese bus company. But eventually, they kind of lost. So that's the very frequent service along the East Coast. But then the spatial reach of this bus company, look at these places, right? Florida, southern part of the country, then Louisiana, right? And then central, right? And then there's so many. I would say maybe about half of the territory of the United States can be reached by the Chinatown bus, right? What a big operation, right? I mean, to do something like this. Now, on the employment agency story, so this is this is the place that we did our survey, and you can see it's pretty much in the new Chinatown, right? So nothing, except one, the Tina Employment Agency. So all these places that we did survey is in the new Chinatown, so to speak, right? And then we did a little bit mapping and so forth. I'm going to skip that there as well. So this map is kind of interesting. It basically shows you along different categories. So the yellow, you know, like a traditional destination, like New York, Illinois, California, is kind of traditional, right? You know, Chinese went to California first to dig the gold. And then the second color in second tier. By second tier, I mean that there's something close to the traditional destination, like New Jersey is considered to be the second tier because it's so close to New York State, right? And then I want you to pay attention to the kind of the red color, right? Yeah, look like a red, maybe purple, but a darker color. These are a new destination that are not considered to be, you know, most popular place for Chinese immigrants, right? But look at these places, right? So here, Arizona, Utah, Colorado, Kansas, and Oregon, right? Yeah. Oh, and when we did a survey, we actually saw the job posted for Alaska. You know, I travel a lot, but I haven't been to Alaska yet. But, you know, the immigrant entrepreneurs, they're having business in Alaska. You know, of course, Puerto Rico, you know, this in Hawaii, of course. And so these two maps just show you a simple story to connect the spatial location with the salary. So that means when the employer posted the job information, they will say, you know, if that job is in this part, you know, right, it's this part. And the darker the color, you can see the red and blue indicating higher salary, right? And so that means you can see here, these places, the salary is pretty high compared to, you know, somewhere closer to New York, right? And that's going to be the quick message. And then we have a statistical model that can carefully look at that, you know, any more variables, and that shows to be the case as well. Now, the key major, the sort of major findings here, in a very broad stroke, so we know it's a, you know, fundamental shift in the settlement pattern of low-skilled immigrants in the U.S., and we also identify what are the location characteristics of this new immigrant open business. And we noticed that they tend not to be in places with a heavy concentration of Asian or Chinese immigrants. So that's a one message. But they tend to be in places, you know, low crime and low unemployment rate and so forth. And then the final message is, you know, when they move away, they tend to be better off, you know, financially. They'll get a better salary. So beyond salary, and then the other I'm just go quickly, I just mention maybe two things about other chapters of the book that I think are very important. One is that, you know, when you think about people moving away from New York City, you may think about, you know, do they continue to maintain the linkages with New York City, right? Yeah, in a book, I argue they actually do. In fact, they maintain what I identify as three linkages. Economic linkage with New York City, religious linkage with New York City, and sometimes political connections, sometimes political connections as well. And so I'm going to just highlight the economic story here. And the economic story is what I call the supply chain story. So, and this is supply chain. It's kind of different from the supply chain when we talk about, you know, for the whole country, right? But for the Chinese operated business, there's a supply chain story here as well. And the supply chain primarily means that, you know, these are places providing the restaurant menus, cookware, furniture, you know, I mentioned about the cameras and so forth. So here I want to read, you know, just the one story from this entrepreneur who operate a printing shop. And I know that even if you're very familiar with Chinatown, you may not be familiar with the printing shop, right? So this is in the new Chinatown, right? It's so somewhere in the Madison Street, about one or two blocks from East Broadway. So I want to read a story about Lin this is not a real name. To learn more about the Chinatown shops that print restaurant menus, I interview Lin, and who owns a printing shop on Madison Street in Chinatown. A longtime business owner friend of mine owns a small seafood retail shop. And so this gentleman owns a retail shop, kind of seafood, and then he provides that to the LA Center, restaurant. Anytime when I go to China, I kind of stop in that shop first. And so one day I stop by, I say, I want to talk to a person who actually operate a printing shop, right? Yeah, printing Chinese restaurant menu. And he said, I know the person, so it's not too far from my shop. So he took me there, but it turns out this owner, Lin, I actually know her father. So remember in 2005, I did a survey of Chinese immigrants at the time, and his father operated a big restaurant called the Mingdu Dajiulou. That's in the East Broadway. It's a big restaurant, so I actually went there a couple of times. So I know her father, and so that's a good starting point. But so Lin talked to me about how she started in her business. And she said, that printing shop was pretty much more or less envisioned by her father, who asked her to major in graphic design in college, and she said, not until I graduated from the college did I realize that I was majoring in graphic design in 1997. So after this, she finished college and she started her business. It was the second printing shop in Chinatown at the time, according to Lin. And Lin's father, being a longtime entrepreneur himself, was a business visionary who saw the demand will rise as immigrant entrepreneurs open new business outside of New York City. So this is in a book, actually, I received permission to take a picture of the office, and where you can see that on page 119, and she posted maybe about 60 manuals, right? And manual itself is kind of interesting. If I have time, I can talk about that as well. And that's a distribution of all the supply chains that we were able to gather information. And the red color are the restaurant menus, shops, and then others kitchen supplies, furniture, and so forth. I learned a lot from talking to these people. So the second story, if I have a little bit of time, I just want to mention quickly, is the Reese story that I mentioned a little bit at the beginning, right, about possible race relation issue. So this is to be that kind of story. But I don't think I have a lot of time. I have quite a few things that I do want to cover. So I want to leave our audience with some messages that I hope that will be helpful, beneficial. So one is that, what is new here? So when you think about a book, what are the new things? If you're a scholar, right? If you review a scholar book, what did I say? What did I say about things that are actually new, right? I think the new thing is that it's kind of departure from a traditional immigrant business model where it's heavily concentrated in individual ambition effort, right? But rather I emphasize other players such as recruitment agency, employment agencies, such as transportation networks, right? And then the mobile workforce. These are the workers, they go from work to work, right? And in addition, I mentioned earlier about immigrant labor market, in my case, is not a regional market, it is actually a national market. And some economists always say, immigrant labor market is kind of a local market, and I argue against that. And the second story I think is kind of new here, emerging from the book, is the idea the Chinese immigrant owned business not only hire Chinese workers, but also Latino workers, right? This is another major topic that researchers we should pay attention to as well. Now, for the non-scholars in the audience, I think there are other messages. I think also it's very important that we need to emphasize as well. If you think about Chinese food, right? So my argument is that the importance of Chinese food, an immigrant who work in a Chinese restaurant, right? They actually affect people across all social economic groups. By that I mean the Chinese restaurants serve upper class people. The Chinese restaurants serve middle-class people. The Chinese restaurants also serve low-income people, right? And the story I was going to talk about, the Philadelphia story, it is the story about Chinese restaurant owners serving low-income people in the neighborhood, right? And I'm thinking about there are many, many food, cuisine in the U.S., right? How many other cuisine that we can think about that can cut across so many layers of, higher class, lower class, middle class, right? Not many. You know, if you think about French food, if you think about Italian food, that's also, some people like. And I don't think they actually can have this kind of impact like the Chinese food. The second thing I think the message is important is that, going to a restaurant in many ways is a family business, right? You go with the whole family, and particularly children, right? It is in this case, I think that the Chinese, nurture the children's interest in the Chinese cultural tradition, and they have a long-term impact that we tend not to pay a lot of attention. And certainly, I think the Chinatown bus today, right? Today, if you go to Chinatown bus in Manhattan, and you will see that they serve majority not Chinese immigrants, right? So I will say 90%, they're not Chinese immigrants. And in fact, they're just, your regular Americans. And to me, that's a very important story to tell, right? Now, it's very close, so this is 2021, November 2021, just one day before Thanksgiving. So I was standing on my beautiful campus in Albany. So I tend to take a walk after lunch, and I saw all the buses, right? The mega bus, right? All these companies there. And this is called the curbside parking, right? And this is what I did. Now, the curbside parking, It's not a tradition of mainstream bus company in the U.S., right? And in fact, it is the Chinese bus company that started this practice of curbside parking, beginning in New York. And now being adopted by all the major bus companies in the U.S., right? And in this case, I think, when we think about the assimilation story, right, this is a term that, scholars always say, assimilation. They tend to imply the idea that immigrants always need to learn to learn the language, learn the customs, and in the market, in the neighborhood. But the other side of the story is that immigrants sometimes the native workers, right, the mainstream organization, they actually adapt the practice of immigrant operation. In this case, the Chinatown bus curbside parking, right? And this is what I call the two-way assimilation. Or assimilation is a two-way street, and that's an important message. And so this is, I mentioned about the Fenghua bus company, discontinued, and this New Yorker magazine writer, and he feel very, very sad. He said, I'm going to compose a song to commemorate the bus company. So this year is, but it's very long. I'm not going to play it. But you can check on Google to play that. So I'm going to save some time. Maybe I already over time. But thank you very much for coming, and I'm looking forward to some questions. Yes, please. Yeah.
But I was curious about the garment industry too, and the workers that were leaving New York City because of the factories moving to North Carolina, South Carolina, and whether that contributed also to where the bus routes went, and then the restaurant owners, all that migration.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. I think the major thing we know about Chinatown, that, you know, I think my colleague, Hunter College, Margaret Ching, yeah, she wrote a book about that. I think one thing about we know about the garment industry is that, you know, when I was doing the work, I sometimes walked in the building, sometimes I see some of the shop there. But I think one consensus was that after 9/11, the garment industry kind of more or less collapsed, right? You know, 9/11 is one thing, but also the competition from a place like China, right? And, you know, it's pretty much make the garment industry very, very difficult. But I still have some friends who are involved in more like a design. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they say, you know, we designed for this, you know, because they can produce quickly. But the scale of the operation, I think, is nothing compared to before 9/11. So I don't know how many garment works have moved to other places, right? Yeah, so the, but if you talk to the boss owners, clearly they're orientation to start company, you know, beginning is to serve the restaurant workers, right? They need to, you know, the thing is that they were having trouble, using green hanbao, right? They don't know where to get off, right? And so they need some kind of service. They can break down the language barriers, and so here we have the Chinatown bus. That in operation, and the Chinatown bus also provide other kind of service. For example, when Lin, I was talking to her, she said, you know, when she produced the menus, and sometimes if the restaurant is not too far from the Chinatown bus stop in that state, and she's going to use that, put that in the bus, and then move to the location of the business.
Okay, so they're just leaving property.
Right. Yeah. And that also true. You know, in the process of doing the project, I was also talking to the immigrant association leaders, right? You know, including the Wellington Chen, the BID executive officer. You know, they have a very clear message that, you know, the garment industry is dramatically reduced.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
We have a few online questions for you.
Yeah.
How long did it take for you to research this book?
Good question, right? Yeah. So I have to admit that I'm kind of a slow worker, but I do enjoy the process. You know, if you look at my CV online, I've done a lot of stuff. But this is the project that, even though it took a long time, I very much enjoy this process. So, depending on how you count it, so I started the work in 2005. You can see that 2005 we tabulate, is that 7 pages, right? That, you know, the and that's a starting point. And then the official starting point, I would say, probably around 2010, when I received this research grant from the Russell Sage Foundation. That allows me to, you know, carry out the survey in Chinatown, the interviews in 6 states. We went to, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and so forth. And that's if you count back 2009, that's also quite a few years, right? Even if I say the project officially started in 2009, the book published last 2023. So that's still a long time. So I'm not a model for quick research, but I think that I put in a lot of time, and that's also, I think the project was kind of delayed because I got involved in another project. But I'm happy eventually. You know, I did get this book, published. Speaking about a book, I think maybe I should mention one thing that the book also took some time, that went through several revisions, and I was very moved by the quality of reviewers, because there are two reviewers, actually. They each wrote about 20 pages of reviews and gave me suggestions on how to improve the work. And so that made me feel very heartwarming. You know, that they took a lot of time, right? And in the process of doing the book, there are other things that also touched my heart. And, you know, for example, one reviewer says, I like your book, not only because, you know, I'm a scholar, I like the work, but also because my father, you know, who is a lawyer, somewhere in, you know, in the southern part of the country, and he knows a Chinese business owner, and they actually become friends. And when the Chinese business owner has some legal issues, he will come talk to my father and sometimes, you know, borrow, you know, fax machine to things. So there are a lot of connection. When people see my book, they find a connection. These are the people who are not Chinese, right? But the thing is, when these people, they say connection, even the copy editor who edited my book, she said, my God, I was a PhD student at New School in New York City. I know exactly what you're talking about. Right, you know, she was editing my book, right? All of a sudden, she said, "I know the story," right? And so that's also kind of a heartwarming process. People see a connection, right? Yeah, you know, I don't want to work something that nobody seems to understand, right? That's kind of sad, but nothing here. Yeah.
Additional question: what are the range of dates of the establishment of Chinese restaurants outside of Chinatown? They also asked the second one, what wave of immigration does your research cover?
Yeah, I think to be precise, you know, even before the massive, you know, restaurant outside of New York, you know, in the post-1990, so the immigration flow, the big increase, right, I have the chart showing, is somewhere around the mid-1990, like maybe 1995, right? So clearly post-1995 is a major, you know, transformative movement, right? But I think even before that, we do have, you know, when my paper being read in, you know, in different conferences, you know, I have some historian who come to talk to me. See, you know, he or she will tell me that I actually know about the restaurant, you know, a long time ago, you know, somewhere far away, maybe somewhere in Texas. But I would say that there's much smaller scale, right? You know, before 1995, right? Certainly you have, you know, in Wyoming, right? You have the New York Times report, you know, one of the oldest restaurants, you know, somewhere in Wyoming. But I would say that they're more like isolated. But to get this kind of a systematic, massive distribution across so many parts of the country, really happened the last, you know, 30 years or so, you know, driven by the large flow of immigrants from Fujian province. I think that's so today when I see my colleague, you know, I know many professors in the country, you know, living in different part of the country, and everybody I talk to, if I mention about Fujianese restaurant, they know something about it. The people from Michigan, they say, yeah, I know something from Fujian, you know, operate business here. I went to Ohio, right? And everybody knows something. So this is not isolated, right? Much more systematic, you know, across the country. That's kind of a taking place. Yeah.
Another question is, do most immigrants who move to new destinations remain there, and if so, for how long? Do they go back to New York City at some point, or is there a permanent move?
Good question. So I think depends on, you know, whether you're talking about entrepreneurs. I think clearly for entrepreneurs, they go there, they like it, and they'll settle, and they'll buy a house there. And for example, the people we talk to in Texas, in Ohio, these are the people who went there. They really like it. You know, they all tell us that, you know, in Texas, money is so good to make, and you know, they're happy. But for workers, I see two trajectories. You know, one type of worker will, you know, work in that one place, you know, work very closely with the business owner, right? They will learn the techniques, the way to operate business. You know, some scholar will say this is like a training machine, right? The training system, sort of, you know, you go through the training system and you become an entrepreneur yourself, right? Yeah, so certainly there will be people, you know, who are ambitious, they follow that path. And then this, another category is just people going from job to job, right? They don't like to. I think right now they say there's too much risk. You know, if you take care of yourself, you know, worker, that's okay. But if you take care of business and then you take care of salary of others, that's a lot more work. So the second category of people I see there, they just say, you know, we just get on the work and then where will pay me more, I'm going to go there and then to go from there. And then there are also category of people who more or less cynical, that they once they make a little bit of money, they say, I'm going to take a break. So when I walk around in employment agency, I often see people who say, I just came back, you know, working 2 or 3 years, and then I need to take a break for 2 or 3 months. And until I'm running out of money, and then I got to go to another job, right? So there are people like that as well. But they are happy, I think. That they kind of satisfied with what they have, whether they're being entrepreneur or they're being, you know, worker.
So you spoke a bit about how and so I was wondering if you could sneak on what that means for, like, individual communities there, and are there certain, like, Chinatowns that are sprouting up in places that haven't been there previously or historically? And because you also mentioned that, like, they're moving to places that historically have not had, like, very dense Asian communities. Mm-hmm. And then also I was wondering if you could speak on what that means for, like, New York City's Chinatown, in the sense that people aren't immigrating to New York City's Chinatown in as large numbers, and kind of what that means for the size and community of individual Chinatowns, which I think historically have been quite different, considering where they are in the country.
I think the first one, what I would emphasize is the idea. This is mainly talking to the entrepreneurs, right? Yeah, because we have a compiled questionnaire. We asked them, you know, how often do you talk to local people, right? How much interaction? I think we see quite a strong connection with local people. There's some examples I'm going to show. You know, one example. So this is a business owner in Florida. I think I may mention in the book that I was very impressed. In terms of how much they engage with community. So meaning that they're not just the business people who go there, they only recognize money, they have no connection with local people. So these are the business people who say they're being asked to donate money to local schools, right? Yeah, they're very active, and their restaurant receive, you know, local, you know, officials, right? And they connect, so they're very much engage with local schools, politics, the politician, they're in good terms. And there's also a story that I there's stories you don't forget. And this one is like, this owner got so much trust from local people. So the example is like this. And so this gentleman and his father, his mother live in this is in Florida. And he's a lawyer, but he's not living with the mother. The mother is probably pretty old, maybe 80 something years old. The lawyer talked to the restaurant owner saying, listen, I'm not in town every day, but you watch my mother's house, right? And then if you see the lights are not open, you know, at night, right? You tell me, right? You know, I want to make sure that the mother is safe. So I can see that the kind of trust that the build between local people and, you know, to that level, so that's something that we not typically observe, right? So that's something. Your second question is about, can you say more about Chinatown in New York City? I didn't quite catch the second question, yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to ask, like, if people aren't immigrating to New York City's Chinatown as much,
right.
What does that mean for New York City's Chinatown?
Yeah, gotcha, yeah. Yeah, so clearly, yeah, I mean, this is a big question. In fact, if you just pay attention to the Atlantic Monthly, there are a lot of writing about, you know, the Chinatown is dead, right? Yeah, there are a lot of people. You know, I was in Washington just 2 weeks ago. People talk about Chinatown is not, you know, operating, right? Clearly, I mean, I mentioned about this. There's old Chinatown, there's new Chinatown. But right now, clearly in the new Chinatown, there's a crisis going on. And the crisis being that, when I was doing the research in 2005, in 2010, there's so many people, like the young immigrants, right? And you can see it. You know, go to the street on East Broadway, it's just everybody's walking, right? And, on all sides. But somehow, you don't see that anymore. The major thing is that these immigrants, they come to an age of getting married, right? They need to have a family. And it is hard to raise. They also tend to have a large family. They have like three children, four children sometimes, right? And they don't see they can make that happen in living in an apartment in Chinatown. So today, as everybody in this room knows, that most of them moved to 8th Avenue, right, in Sunset Park, in Brooklyn. And others moved to Flushing. And the business people feel that, right? And so in addition, my story says there are a lot of people moving outside of New York entirely, right? And they are now in Texas, right? And that's a big story. And they see that. And over time, they see this. They lost a lot of business, like wedding banquet. One time they were saying, I don't worry about, as long as I have regular wedding banquets, business will be okay. But they're saying today, they're not as many. They're just worried. And then COVID even hit even harder. So clearly there's a, as we know, the big restaurant in along East Broadway, Yidongjiulou, right, the 88 Palace, right, East Broadway, that closed. Since COVID, even today, it's closed, right? And that's a place I met many immigrants. I talked to them in that second floor, right? And that the 88 Palace in East Broadway, the first floor used to be busting with all kind of business, but today it's kind of empty. And the good news is that I don't know how many people know that the governor of New York, she promised big money to support Chinatown. And as my memory is like $20 million to help rebuild Chinatown, and that's how. In addition, I'm also in the process of doing this work. I'm very heartwarming to learn that there are many second-generation Chinese-American, Asian-American, and during COVID, they rose up. I mean, this is something that I just so touching. And like, welcome to Chinatown, right? And Think Chinatown, these are the non-profit organizations, right? And then there are others who just, one or two person. One story that I know, he just tried to help. He's a barber, and he says, if you show me a receipt, like spending $60, I'm going to give you a free haircut. Right? I mean, everybody do their share. I mean, these are young people. I'm much older than them, right? They're like 20 years, they're 30 years. They're very committed to Chinatown, and that's something very, very good, powerful. So I guess my position is that I'm very optimistic for the future of Chinatown, right?
How many Chinese takeouts are there? And also, closing? Typically, restaurants have a 90% failure rate, but this applies to takeout. And also, does the average Chinese takeout worker make minimum wage?
This is, good question. So this is about, particularly about takeout. So our study, so I have to be honest, so our study didn't particularly focus on the takeout. So our study looking at the employers, when they post the salary, these are typically workers working in the restaurant, right? They're not, but I think they're also takeout. I think my understanding nowadays is the takeout story is the kind of, after COVID, right, we know that takeout become more popular, right, because during COVID that, people used to, order instead of, dining in the premise of the restaurant. So clearly this is the big operation. So I guess the kind of, I can see two kind of, one is the takeout a worker connected with the platform, right? You have the you know, DoorDash, right? You have the Hungry Panda. These are the people connected, and they actually pay the salary. So I think if you look at that data, so I remember last time this platform saying that we're going to increase the minimum wage for the workers, right? But then they will also increase the service charge, and that also, you know, that additional increase will be imposed to the customers, right? So I see that the, you know, there's a platform organization, and then there's customers. Somehow the deliver people kind of being squeezed somehow in there. But the thing is, my research, we didn't particularly focus on the you know, delivery people, but I know that's a big story. In fact, I remember reading you know, during the we have 2 years ago, we have like a hurricane, and so there's a delivery Chinese gentleman in Brooklyn, right? Yeah, he was riding a bicycle. You know, the water was this high, and he was on the way to deliver food. Was very precautious, and then and this reporter, he took that picture. He said, you know, look, this is how the Chinese deliver people are working, you know, even during, and then I think the mayor or the governor saying, you know, when the weather is so bad, please try not to, you know, order food, because, you know, the workers actually really facing challenges. So clearly this is a group that we need to pay more attention to, but my research hasn't quite done enough on this topic.
Okay, one last question before we conclude. A similar bus transportation networks developed in other gateway states such as California, or was that more or less unique to the West Coast?
Yeah, actually, for this reason, you know, one time there was the American Sociological Association was in San Francisco, so I thought, you know, maybe this is the middle of doing my work, and I thought maybe I'm going to have a similar story. So I went around in San Francisco. I didn't see a Chinese bus company, but I'm sure there are some employment agencies, but nothing in the scale of what we saw here, right? Yeah. So there's, I see there post some employment, but in the mid 2000s, I don't think there are many employment agencies. I think the main thing may be that the new immigrants actually they really look for place like New York, not, you know, California, right? I mean, the majority of immigrants, because this is the place, the you know, the low skilled workers, that's also being reflected in the aggregate data from census. If you look at census, a lot of low skilled workers actually based in the New York City, and one can also look at that from the number of immigrant organizations. So in one of the papers I did on the immigrant organization alone in New York City, right? Yeah, and for the Fujian-related organizations, like more than 80 Fujian organizations in New York City alone, right? I mean, we haven't talked about the, you know, the organization about, you know, Guangdong, but this is primarily catered to the new immigrants. So this is clearly the center of immigrant. In addition, I need to say that all these supply shops, right? You know, these 20 or so shops that identify. I was asking the same question. I say, you know, you can survive in New York City, but why is that the case? Why don't they order from California, right? It's, for example, cookware, for example, menu. And they say, well, because most of the owners, they're from Fujian province. Right? They're kind of loyal to the, you know, the base of their operation. This is where they started, right? All their connections in New York City. And many of them, by the way, they actually operate more than one restaurant. Yeah, and some of the supply chain owners, they're saying, you know, I really have to take care of this customer, because that customer, he has more business, right? You know, that, you know, it's not just one person. It's, you know, multiple business this person owns.
Thank you to Professor Liang for a wonderful talk. You can purchase from Chinatown to every town here for $35 and online. And with that, enjoy the rest of your Friday evening. Happy Easter weekend to you folks. And remember to be upstander if you see a fellow person in need. Thank you.